His answer has stuck with me throughout my entire career and is something that I've shared with the hundreds of young women I've mentored over the years. He told me, "Because you're smart and you make my life easier." All those hours I had spent editing down presentations paid off. By taking on more than was asked of me, I had proven my diligence and effectiveness. I had looked up and seen what my boss really needed and then stepped up. 2, take something off his or her list. Here's another thing I did for my boss at Coke that was a win for us both. Observing the constant demands on his time, I offered to take initial meetings with outside vendors and other people who were looking to get on his calendar. Again, I wasn't just doing this to help him. I was stepping up and filling in the gaps that I saw as opportunities. By taking these meetings, I was able to gain valuable experience and knowledge that I wouldn't have otherwise gotten at that stage of my career. This move was also good for the company and for my boss because we were able to say yes to more meetings. So many women in junior positions simply wait for their bosses to assign them specific jobs. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not exactly ambitious. Get out of your head and look at what's going on around you. Is your boss stressed and overwhelmed? If so, is there anything you can do to be helpful? Look at what this person needs to get done and how you can contribute. Then go in and offer to step up and take on a specific task. Perhaps you can take a first stab at a report or a presentation she has to create, or do some research that you know she'll need. As a boss, I was always so relieved and grateful anytime one of my team members offered to put together a first draft of a report for me. And chances are that if you participate in this way, you'll end up in the meeting where the report is being presented, gaining exposure and knowledge in the process. This approach is so much more ambitious than merely asking, "How can I help?" Offering to help is nice, but without volunteering to take on a definite and specific task, it puts the onus on the other person. In other words, figuring out how you can help her is now just one more thing she has to do. Instead, make yourself aware of what needs doing and how you can do it. This is not just nice or a mode of serving others. It's a powerful way of stepping up and a great opportunity to gain experience working on high-profile initiatives. Create opportunities. If you really want to be successful, it's not enough to just step up into opportunities that are ready and waiting to be filled. Sometimes you must create those opportunities for yourself. Taking the initiative is an important way to establish yourself as someone who is creative, ambitious, and proactive. While you're working on stepping up and into opportunities that are out there, don't forget about the endless opportunities that have yet to be identified. What can you create from scratch? These may be ideas for new customer segments, cost savings opportunities, or new technologies your company is not currently exploring. For example, when I was at MoviePhone, my colleague Cheryl Grossman and I realized that we had been so focused on selling advertising to movie studios that we were completely ignoring potential advertising revenue from other brands. I wanted to create a team that would focus on this, but I was concerned that taking the initiative would ruffle feathers. This is where being a nice girl came in handy. I went to my peers first, specifically the chief revenue officer and the head of research, and got their input by asking them, "We're killing it with movie studios, but maybe we're leaving some money on the table when it comes to other brands. What are you guys seeing?" Once I had their buy-in, I went to my boss and told him I wanted to create a small team that would focus on unlocking some advertising revenue from other brands. He gave me the go-ahead to hire 2 people to create this team, and we were very successful, in part because we already had the full support of my peers. When you are creating opportunities, it's essential to find the key stakeholders and bring them along with you. Make them a part of the process. By making it clear that you are looking to collaborate instead of compete, you'll earn their trust and their respect. How you present the idea itself is also important. Once I became a boss, I noticed right away that my male and female employees often proceeded completely differently when they had an idea they wanted to run by me. In general, the men would pop by my office and give me a quick elevator pitch, while the women would approach me with a fully fleshed out and beautifully put together presentation. There's nothing wrong with being prepared. In fact, I highly recommend it. It's certainly nice to show that you've put some real thought into an idea before bringing it to your boss. But the truth is that you can create a lot more opportunities if you're not spending dozens of hours working on each one before even getting your boss's feedback. This is where you veer into people-pleasing territory. To create an opportunity, start with a casual conversation, and then if you receive an enthusiastic response, move on to a more formal proposal. For this initial conversation, give him or her the headline first. What is the subject you are there to discuss? Then break your idea down into three bullet points that summarize: 1, the opportunity you are capitalizing on, or the problem you're trying to solve; 2, a few data points that demonstrate the size of the opportunity; and 3, why you're the one to address it. Then if you get a no, well, no harm done. You haven't invested too much into this idea, and you're free to come up with another great opportunity. The downside of likability: people-pleasing. While you work on channeling your niceness to fuel your ambitions in the workplace, remember to draw a line between being nice in a strong way and simply being a people-pleaser. That is, focusing on being liked and catering to others at your own expense. Being both strong and nice is possible, but it is a delicate balance. When you veer into people-pleaser territory, it is very difficult to be seen as a strong leader instead of a pushover who's incapable of making tough decisions. Even today, the importance of pleasing others is so ingrained in women from the time we're young girls that it's often difficult to even recognize when we're doing something to please someone else and when it's actually what we want to do. When being likable is important to us, it's incredibly easy to tiptoe over this line before realizing that we're putting someone else's needs ahead of our own. This is something I still struggle with, so I want to take a moment here to draw your attention to the small yet essential difference between being nice, likable, and being a people pleaser. As you go through this list, take a moment to reflect on the key differences between these two concepts. Nice is positive, yet honest and straightforward. People pleaser is sweeping things under the rug to avoid making waves. Research from Duke University showed that MBA graduates entering the workforce had an easier time finding jobs and higher starting salaries when they had a positive outlook and believed that their work could contribute to the company beneficially. As time went on, they were also promoted more frequently than their pessimistic peers. I certainly consider being positive an important aspect of being authentically nice, but if you're so focused on avoiding conflict that you sweep potential problems under the rug, you're not being nice. You're just being a people pleaser. There was a time when I fell into this very trap. When I was a vice president of programming for AOL, I was working on a presentation for one of the executives. My team was tasked with presenting 5 ideas that would each generate over $1 million for the company. Everyone on the team worked hard and did their part to come up with enough ideas. But then the day before the big meeting, they shared them with me, and I was disappointed. I just didn't think their ideas were strong enough. Because my first thought was that I didn't want to cause a problem for my boss by simply asking for more time, I stayed up that whole night, readying a new list of ideas to present the next day. Unfortunately, my presentation did not go over well. In the meeting, my team members were shocked when they saw what I had done. Where were all the ideas they had worked so hard to come up with? In the end, the whole presentation fell flat. My team wasn't prepared to back me up on my ideas. And worst of all, I had done this to myself. While I had been trying to please everyone, specifically my boss by not asking for more time, and my team by not asking for more work from them, I had ended up disenfranchising and disappointing everyone in the room. Looking back, it's so clear to me what I should have done differently. Asking the team to send me their ideas the day before the presentation wasn't nearly enough lead time to make sure we were on track. I should have had a better handle on where we were with the ideas much, much sooner. But if I could go back and do this over again, if only, I would tell my boss, "The ideas we have aren't as strong as they could be, and I don't want to waste your time presenting them to you. I'd rather empower the team by going back to them and giving them guidance. I'm confident that we can get there with a little more time." Far from causing problems, this tactic would have still allowed me to remain positive because it presents a solution instead of a problem. Yet, it's facing the problem in an honest and authentic way. That would have been the nice, effective version of what I did. Instead, I tried to please everyone and ended up pleasing no one in the process. Nice is helpful. People pleaser is subservient. Unfortunately, sexism is alive and well in the workplace, and women are asked to run errands, get coffee, and do favors far more often than men. Obviously, this can be demeaning and a waste of our time. Yet, part of being likable and authentically nice is being helpful and going out of our way for others. So where do you draw the line? This is a rule I established early in my career. I've always been happy to do favors or errands for others, if and only if I had an authentic desire to do so, or if I had a strategic reason for doing it. For example, when I was executive producer at Time Inc. Interactive, my team was working late on a big presentation. I went to Starbucks and got them all coffee to keep them awake and motivated. When I was in more junior positions, I said yes whenever someone more senior asked for a favor. I knew that these people could be helpful to me down the road, so I was happy to help them. But there have been many times when someone has asked me to do something and I simply had to say no. The most egregious example of this was when I was at MoviePhone. My team flew to Los Angeles for a meeting with a big movie studio. We were all sitting around the conference table when the studio executive came in. I was the only woman on my team. He went around the table and shook all of our hands, and when he came to me, he asked, "Can you please get me a cup of coffee?" My brain went into overdrive. I wanted to say no, but I heard all the alarm bells warning me against being rude and unlikable. At the same time, I knew that if I got him the coffee, it would sabotage my authority in the meeting. That would have been a real people-pleaser move. Finally, I stood up, shook his hand, and said, "I'm Fran Hauser. I run MoviePhone." He realized his error and asked his assistant to get him the coffee. It's helpful to create guidelines so that you know what type of tasks you are going to say yes or no to. This way, you'll never get caught off guard by a request that you find yourself saying yes to and regretting later. I've seen a lot of women act passive-aggressively at work, and when I talk to them about it, I realize that it stems from resentment about all of the subservient things they've agreed to do. This is an all-too-common downside of being a people-pleaser, and it can get in the way of your performance and success at work. For example, when I was at AOL, I noticed that a junior designer named Jackie was rolling her eyes and making snide comments in meetings. One day, after a meeting, I asked her if she had a minute. We went into my office, and I said, "I've noticed in some meetings lately that you haven't been yourself. It seems like something is bothering you, and I want to understand what's going on to see if I can help." Jackie was hesitant at first. "I'm not sure I feel comfortable talking to you about this," she said. I told her that she should always feel comfortable talking to me about anything that was related to her performance at work. Finally, Jackie shared that she was tired of being the errand girl for the entire design team. Jackie was 25. This was her second job out of college, and she was a designer, not an assistant or coordinator. Yet she happened to be the most junior person on the team, so certain tasks automatically fell to her. I asked Jackie to talk to me a little more about what she meant. As we talked through some of the responsibilities and chores she resented, I found that there were some, such as making copies for the other designers, that she'd probably have to keep doing. "I remember doing that early in my career," I told her. It seemed to help her to hear that she wasn't being singled out. Making copies was typically the most junior team member's responsibility. But there were some tasks Jackie was doing that didn't seem quite right. For example, every afternoon, she was asked to go out and get snacks and coffee for the entire team. It was a huge disruption to her workday because she never knew when someone would ask her to go out. And then she'd have to stop whatever she was doing to collect orders from everyone before running the errand. I suggested that Jackie talk to her manager by saying, "I'd like to get your advice on something. I love helping out the team, and I want to be a team player. But it's disrupting to go out and get snacks for everyone when I'm in the middle of designing." Framed this way, she wasn't complaining, but she was standing up for herself. Jackie's boss responded positively and decided to create a sign-up sheet so that different team members would take turns going out to get snacks. When it was Jackie's turn, she'd know ahead of time and could control when she wanted to take a break to collect orders and go out. Jackie was able to focus more on her job, and even better, her attitude turned around, and she became much more positive and willing to contribute in meetings. If you're feeling unsure of whether you're being taken advantage of, or if the tasks that are being asked of you are normal for your particular company's culture, ask someone at the company whom you trust for their advice. It can be a peer or a mentor or even your boss. So much of this is culture dependent. There are, of course, general standards regarding what's appropriate, but it's always helpful to talk to someone at the company who can provide additional insight. Nice is humble. People pleaser is putting yourself down. When you are a strong, ambitious woman, a little bit of humor and lightness goes a long way. It's endearing when any leader, male or female, doesn't take themselves too seriously. By showing a bit of humanity, it disarms those around you and makes you appear relatable and unthreatening. However, it's important not to go too far and actually put yourself down, or you risk projecting a negative self-image that could end up holding you back. For example, when I was at AOL, I had a colleague named Marcia who was often running late. But worse, she was constantly putting herself down by saying things like, "I'm the worst," or "I just can't get my act together." The first time I heard her say this type of thing, I thought it was funny and it made her seem more human. After all, Marcia was a successful woman in a senior position at the company. And it's possible that she was doing this on purpose to try and make people feel more comfortable around her. But by saying these things over and over, Marcia was undermining her own credibility. She presented herself as being so disorganized and self-conscious that people who were making decisions sometimes skipped over her and asked someone else on her team for their opinion instead. A few times she disagreed with a decision that had been made, which caused a great deal of conflict and dysfunction within her department. There's a fine line between humility and self-deprecation. Pay attention to the way you talk about yourself. If it sounds harsh, critical, or demeaning, try to present yourself with a stronger dose of self-respect. You should never have to put yourself down to lift someone else up. Likeable plus competent equals lovable star. I'm not the only one who has noted the importance of likability at work. Harvard Business Review found that when deciding whom they'd want to work with, people value likability more highly than competence. If someone was highly unlikable, their competence became irrelevant. However, if someone was well-liked but lacking in competence, their colleagues were more likely to judge them kindly and want to work with them to improve their competence. HBR termed the people who are both likable and competent lovable stars. These lovable stars have the exact combination of likability and ambition that so many women struggle to achieve. Research from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill also confirms this conclusion. They looked at the distinction between status and likability, particularly when it comes to teenage girls and boys, and found that the boys could have high status and likability, while the girls who were admired were not often liked. However, when researchers followed up with teenagers 10 years after high school, they found that the girls who'd been likable, defined as caring, kind, and open, and who had used those skills in business, had more positive life outcomes. Meanwhile, the high-status teen girls, aka mean girls, weren't doing as well 10 years later. They had less successful relationships and were more likely to have problems with drugs and alcohol. This goes hand in hand with the research you read about in Chapter 1, which found that being trustworthy was more important than being competent when it came to how someone was perceived at work. In fact, all of these studies resoundingly contradict the status quo and the conventional business world assumption that you have to be cutthroat and ruthless in order to get ahead. While niceness is commonly viewed as a weakness, my experience and this research prove its crucial importance. And when you pair your ambition with your authentic niceness, they can become the tools you need to succeed. Key takeaways. There is a double standard against ambitious women. The more successful and ambitious a woman is, the less likable she becomes. But it is possible to push back against this perception and become successful and well-liked. To do this, take credit for your ideas while being inclusive. Step up, even when you are unsure that you are a perfect fit for a job. And find ways to create opportunities for yourself that will benefit you and the company you work for. Being nice does not mean being a people pleaser. Never sweep things under the rug simply to avoid making waves. Act subservient or put yourself down. Instead, being positive, honest, helpful, and humble will make you a naturally kind and strong leader. Chapter 3. Speak up assertively and nicely. I recently spoke about leading with compassion to a group of about 100 university students, most of whom were female. When my talk was over and it was time for the question and answer session, I noticed that out of the 20 or so hands that went up, only one of them belonged to a female student. Yet after I finished answering the questions and I was leaving the stage, several female students lined up to have a chance to speak with me one-on-one. After the event was over, I spent some time talking to the dean of the business school, and I pointed out what I'd noticed about the female students who seemed more comfortable talking to me individually than asking a question in front of the entire group. He responded by saying, "The exact same thing happens at every single event, no matter who the speaker is." It struck me that these young women, who had so impressed me with their confidence and intelligence in our one-on-one conversations, were still holding themselves back by not speaking up in front of others. But it really shouldn't have surprised me. Throughout my career, I've observed how many women have this tendency to remain quiet at work in group situations. And as you read earlier, this is something that I actively had to fight against myself. Once I did find my voice, I saw that it was necessary to speak up in order to be as effective as possible in my role. Yet many of the women around me still fell into the trap of being seen as ineffective or weak because they never took a vocal stand. No matter how brilliant and impressive these women may have been in one-on-one discussions, not speaking up in meetings hurt their chances of succeeding professionally. When women don't share their ideas with a large number of people, their contributions are easily overlooked, and it's difficult for them to be seen as leaders. People naturally want to follow people who take a stand and voice their opinions with confidence. Speaking up isn't just important for your own career advancement. Your thoughts, ideas, and opinions are valuable, and if they're not heard, it is truly a missed opportunity. In 2014, Scientific American published a groundbreaking special report on how diversity powers innovation. By studying decades of research, they concluded that groups with a diversity of race, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation are more creative and innovative than homogeneous groups. As a result, hearing multiple and diverse opinions consistently leads to better business outcomes. This means that no matter what industry you work in, you can help your company and your own career if you learn to speak up and add your unique and valuable perspective. The disease to please. So why do so many women still subconsciously sabotage their own success by not speaking up? For one thing, women who do speak assertively are often perceived as being overly aggressive or pushy, a double standard that makes it difficult for women to know how to voice their opinions without seeming opinionated in a negative way to their peers. This goes back to a tendency to want to please others. Taking a stand will inevitably alienate someone, or so we assume. So instead, we play it safe. Act as people pleasers and keep quiet. This people-pleasing habit often begins in childhood. According to research by Joanne Deke, PhD, when girls are between the ages of 8 and 12, they first become aware of how others perceive them and start camouflaging what they really think and feel in order to blend in better with their peers. These girls don't want to stand out, so they stop speaking up and voicing their opinions and start acting like everyone else in order to please others and fit in. Before this kicks in, most girls have no problem expressing their own perspectives, which if you spent any time with a girl under the age of 8, you undoubtedly already know. But many of the tween and teenage girls Deke spoke to admitted to remaining quiet, even when they had an opinion or important knowledge on subject, to avoid being seen as too eager, annoying, or overbearing. This may seem like a normal part of being a teenager, but its long-range impact can actually be very damaging. When girls begin camouflaging their true selves, just as their identities are developing, they lose out on an important chance to discover what they really think and feel, and how to best express that. As a result, despite decades of women's empowerment messaging, many women in the workplace still struggle with this tendency to camouflage, hide, or dilute their thoughts and ideas, rather than communicate them directly. It's one of the key issues that my mentees ask me about, how to speak both kindly and assertively, and was the number one question from the women around the country I surveyed. Here are some of the things they had to say. If I keep quiet, my boss thinks I have nothing to add. But if I speak up too often, my coworkers think I'm a bitch. I just can't win. I naturally communicate in a straightforward style, but this is often taken the wrong way, and people think I'm being rude. I resent feeling like I have to act like somebody else at work just to get along. I have a really hard time speaking up in meetings. I usually think that other people's opinions are more valuable than mine, and I don't want to waste people's time by talking just to hear my own voice. Does any of this sound familiar? It sure did to me. It's incredibly difficult to feel like you're constantly bumping up against an implicit bias that as an assertive woman, you're being perceived as rude, pushy, and even angry. Unfortunately, additional biases can make this even more complex. I recently spoke about this with Anna Chavez, the author, speaker, attorney, and former CEO of Girl Scouts of the USA. As a strong, successful woman of color, Anna felt throughout her career that she was unfairly labeled as angry or aggressive when she simply voiced her opinion at work. Yet she also had to fight to be taken seriously, an almost impossible balancing act to pull off. Anna told me about one situation early in her career. It was the first time she had been sent out to represent a federal agency in an enforcement hearing. She was barely 2 years out of law school and looked young for her age. She walked into the hearing room in Aurora, Colorado, and found several men already seated at the conference table. One of the officials looked at Anna and asked her if she knew when the hearing officer would be arriving, because he and his corporate colleagues were very busy and needed to get back to their office. He assumed that she was a secretary or paralegal. Anna paused and said, "Well, you're lucky. The hearing officer is here, and I am ready to start the proceedings." All of the men were shocked that Anna would be determining the outcome of this federal hearing. And throughout the proceedings, Anna found herself trying to prove her gravitas to these men, while still coming across as likable. In the years since then, Anna has learned to stay true to herself by focusing on the good she was trying to do through her job, and always trying to act as a model to others by treating them in the way she wanted to be treated. It may sound like a cliche, but this focusing inward helped her display a quiet confidence that strikes that difficult balance between strong and kind, assertive and empathetic. To me, Anna is living proof that we don't have to give up our niceness to be powerful. We can make room for others and take up an appropriate amount of space for ourselves. It doesn't diminish anyone else for you to stand up straight and speak with authority. In fact, it's a gift to other women to take the space and airtime that you need, because the more women stop camouflaging themselves, the more we lead the way for every woman and girl to be as powerful as they can be. Speak up strategies. Back when I was struggling with all of this, my boss saw that I was having difficulty contributing in meetings and noted how very different this was from his experience of me when we met one-on-one. To urge me to speak up more, he began giving me assignments before each meeting. He would call and say, "Fran, in today's meeting, I'm going to ask you to give everyone an update on the restructuring." This gave me time to prepare my thoughts and contribute in a way that felt comfortable to me. My boss did this before a handful of meetings until I realized that I did have worthwhile things to say, with or without these assignments. And the more I spoke up, the more comfortable I felt about doing so unprompted. If all bosses encourage their female employees to speak up this way, I feel it would make a huge difference in the way women, and especially younger women, contribute at work. In this spirit, think about how you can help support your female peers who may be afraid to speak up. I see women sitting silently in almost every meeting I attend. One of the things I like to do is acknowledge and gently press a woman who I see is having a hard time speaking up by saying something like, "Sarah and I were discussing this earlier, and I really appreciated her perspective. Sarah, can you share your thoughts with the group?" Yes, it does help when you've prepped this person in advance so she's ready when you turn to her instead of simply putting her on the spot. Another tactic I use is to give new team members the opportunity to enjoy a small win that will boost their confidence, and then I acknowledge the win in a group meeting. For example, Maria just hit her target goal yesterday. Congratulations. Can you let the team know how you did that? While I was working on finding my voice, I relied on the following techniques to encourage myself to say more and have more of a presence in meetings. I prepared ahead of time by looking at the agenda and doing my homework so I knew I would have something of value to add. If there was no published agenda, I asked the meeting convener for a list of topics to expect. Before every meeting, I made an active commitment to myself to make at least one comment in the meeting, besides the simple throwaway line like, yes, or that's interesting. Rather than wait for an opening, I wanted to be nice and avoid interrupting, I made an effort to speak first when a topic was opened up for comments. Then I started with a stock phrase to get myself started, such as, I have a suggestion. I did some informal research and discovered, here's what I've been thinking. I also came up with a few phrases that helped me jump into the middle of a conversation. I really like that perspective, and that reminds me of, following on that, I wonder if we. Another technique I started using almost subconsciously was to actually repeat half of another person's sentence and then build onto that thought. At first, this was simply a way for me to feel comfortable speaking up, but my colleagues have repeatedly told me that it helps them feel more confident in their own opinions. Anything that helps both parties feel more positively about how they're communicating is definitely a win-win. Speech weakeners and strengtheners. When you do speak up, make sure to do so from a position of authority and strength. As you read earlier, women sometimes camouflage their thoughts and opinions in many unconscious ways that dilute their effectiveness. There are specific habits and phrases that either strengthen or weaken our speech. Very often we do these subconsciously, perhaps as a result of the camouflaging we started back in grade school. If you're not sure whether you were guilty of any of these, ask a trusted colleague to pay attention to what you say and how you say it in a meeting and to give you honest feedback. Then commit to eliminating the habits that dampen your effectiveness. Sorry, not sorry. One thing that women do too often to avoid coming across as bitchy or rude is apologize, even when we have done nothing wrong. You are probably already familiar with this phenomenon. Have you ever found yourself apologizing when someone else bumps into you? Or have you ever gotten the wrong meal at a restaurant and apologized profusely to the waiter for sending it back? The journal Psychological Science published a study that showed women do indeed apologize more frequently than men. Unfortunately, when we do this at work, it can cause us to seem like pushovers. When I realized that I was apologizing too much at work, I became determined to break this habit. I started by searching my sent emails for all mentions of the word sorry to get a better sense of when, how, and to whom I had been apologizing without realizing it. I soon found that I'd apologized for all sorts of things, like waiting more than a day to respond to an email. Hi, John, I'm sorry it's taken me so long to respond. Or that I wasn't available to meet at the time a colleague suggested. I'm so sorry I won't be available then, but how about? Reading these emails, it was so clear to me that I had accidentally been putting myself in a weak position by apologizing for these trivial things. Why was I implying that I was responsible for responding to the email immediately, or that I was expected to work around the other person's schedule? Without realizing it, I had been making myself seem subservient. From that point on, I started rereading all of my emails before sending them, specifically to make sure they didn't include unnecessary apologies. I also downloaded the brilliant Just Not Sorry Gmail plugin, a Google Chrome extension that highlights phrases in your emails that may be undermining the real message you want to send. It was also helpful for me to replace my automatic sorry with something else. When I sat down and thought about what I was actually trying to convey with the word sorry, I realized that what I really wanted to communicate was my gratitude and appreciation for the other person's time. So I started replacing I'm sorry with thank you. It's a simple tweak, but this dynamic truly changes everything. Saying thank you is much stronger than I'm sorry, and is much more aligned with what I was really trying to express in the first place. If you have a tendency to overuse the word sorry, think about what you're really trying to say. Try to find another word or phrase that's stronger and closer to your true intent. Remember, there's never a need to apologize if you haven't done anything wrong. But sorry isn't the only word that can weaken a nice woman's speech. Nicole Williams, author of the book Girl on Top, identified the following speech weakeners that women often use in our attempts to be accommodating. Start paying attention to whether or not you do any of these. For the first two, you can read over your emails to make sure you're not including them. For the others, try to find a coworker who can act as an accountability buddy and give you a signal every time you apologize unnecessarily or accidentally weaken your speech. The more aware you become of this, the easier it will be for you to speak up confidently and clearly. Common speech weakeners. Voicing an opinion by saying, "I might be wrong about this, but..." By starting your sentence this way, you are discrediting your own idea before you even say it. Failing to take ownership of your idea by saying, "I feel," instead of "I know." Making an assertion into a question by raising your voice at the end of your sentence. This phenomenon, also known as upspeak, is one of the main ways that women make themselves seem passive instead of strong and proactive. Shrugging or looking down when speaking. This kind of body language makes us seem less confident and capable. Communicating a lack of commitment to our statements by allowing our voice to trail off at the end of our sentence. Of course, one of the main reasons women end up using the above speech weakeners in the first place is that we're afraid that if we voice a strong opinion, we'll be perceived as being overly aggressive. But the truth is that you don't have to choose between staying quiet and sounding harsh. You can express yourself clearly and strongly and still be perceived as the authentically kind person that you are. To find the right balance, let's take a look at a situation that requires speaking up and examine three options for how to do it most effectively. Let's say you're in a team meeting discussing a situation where a definitive recommendation needs to be made. There's a lot of discussion back and forth and a lot of swirl, but no one is taking a stand. You feel that you have a good idea on how to proceed. Here are three ways in which you can choose to speak up. 1. Too weak. I'm not sure how everyone else will feel about this, but I think this displays that you're not confident in your recommendation and relies too much on feelings rather than facts. 2. Too abrupt. I figured it out. Here's what we're doing. This centers only on you as a person and doesn't give credit to anyone else who contributed during the brainstorming session. 3. Just right. Hearing everyone's thoughts has been really clarifying for me. Here's what I think we should do to move forward. This is a good balance between acknowledging others' input and confidently voicing your opinion. Like Goldilocks said, this one is just right. Remember, striking this balance is going to take practice. The important thing is that you commit to making your voice heard, and the words will get easier over time. Disagreeing nicely. Speaking up and voicing your own opinions means you'll inevitably disagree with other people from time to time. How can you do this without feeling like you're picking a fight or alienating the other person? This tension is something that made speaking up difficult for me when I first began my career. The very concept of disagreeing vocally was not aligned with my background as someone who was always taught to be polite and respectful. It just never occurred to me to express my own contradictory opinions. It was rude to disagree in public, right? So when I disagreed with something that came up at work, I remained silent, especially if the person I disagreed with was senior to me. I first began pushing back when my boss encouraged me to do so at Ernst & Young. But I didn't fully make the adjustment until I was at Coke, and my boss there said, "I expect people to debate me, question me, and disagree openly, because I believe this is the way to build the best products and businesses." This concept was so foreign to me, but that's what he was asking for, and of course I wanted to deliver, so I had to actively and consciously change my perspective. I started debating with him openly. In truth, this didn't feel right to me either, but over time, I learned that I could voice a contrary opinion with a sense of empathy by making an effort to see the situation from the other person's perspective. I found that if you think about whom you're talking to and what he or she cares about, it's much easier to express your point of view without accidentally rubbing the other person the wrong way. This gives you the best chance of being heard, even when you're expressing a contrarian point of view. This approach helped me substantially with presenting my views. It also helped me find the balance between being nice and assertive. Here are my tips. Rely on the power of questioning. When I disagree with someone, my first step is to ask a lot of questions to try and understand the critical junctures in the other person's thought process. When you learn more about where someone you disagree with is coming from, you may find yourself coming around to their position. Alternatively, they may observe on their own that there is a flaw in their logic or decision-making process. Even if you still disagree after hearing their answers, asking questions is an important aspect of communicating, especially when you disagree with someone. It shows that you are being thoughtful and will hopefully illuminate the other person's thinking. Posing questions has also often helped me stand firmer in my own convictions. These are a few questions I rely on in a disagreement. Can you tell me about how you came to that conclusion? What source did you use for that data point? What led you to that assumption? Get an outside perspective. One approach that I recommend is talking to other people who have a deep understanding of what the person I'm trying to communicate with is thinking. I recall when a woman I mentored named Layla started a new job as the director of marketing at a company that created event management software. After a few weeks on the job, she found that she and her colleague, Carlos, who was the director of sales, did not see eye to eye about where the marketing department's responsibilities ended, and the sales team's job began. Layla knew she had to have a direct conversation with Carlos about this, or else she'd feel like she was being a pushover. But she was dreading the conversation and didn't want to ruffle feathers so early in her tenure at the company. I suggested that before talking to Carlos, Layla go to one or two people who worked closely with him to probe more deeply into his perspective by finding out more about the company's history. This wasn't about going behind Carlos's back, but instead gaining a deeper understanding of the overall context so that Layla could fully appreciate where Carlos was coming from. You may be wondering why I didn't suggest that she just go and ask Carlos himself. Well, first of all, Layla already knew what Carlos thought. What she didn't know was why. Sometimes it's hard for people to be objective about what forms their own opinions. By talking to people who worked closely with Carlos, Layla received valuable insight into his thought process that was both accurate and objective. She also developed a sense of context, which is essential when preparing a counterargument. It's easy to walk into a new situation with your guns blazing and start making immediate changes. And sometimes organizations do need a fresh eye to see where things can be improved. But it's also important to respect a company's history and culture. The people who've been there longer than you and are invested in the company's ways are likely to take real offense to any drastic changes. You can use your authentic niceness to push through necessary changes by first educating yourself about how the company has handled business in the past, and more importantly, why. For example, I told Layla to find out why the marketing and sales departments were set up the way they were, by asking the CEO to explain how those departments had evolved since the company's inception. She learned that back when Carlos had first started at the company, it was so small that he was in charge of both sales and marketing. When the company grew and they hired a marketing person, Carlos handed over the responsibilities that he enjoyed the least and continued doing everything else himself. From Layla's perspective, the team divisions were inefficient, and while that was certainly a valid observation, she needed to keep in mind that Carlos had created these departments from the ground up and was fully committed to keeping things the way they were. I told Layla that she had the right to stand up and suggest some changes, but acknowledging the company's history would help her do so in a kind and empathetic way that wouldn't shock or offend Carlos. Start from their side. When it was finally time to have the key conversation, I suggested that Layla start by making it clear that she had taken the time to see the company from Carlos's perspective. She could say, "Here's my understanding of where you're coming from, and by all means, please correct me if I'm wrong." This respectfully showed Carlos that she cared about his perspective before she shared her own. Once he saw that Layla had empathy for his point of view and wasn't going to jam any major changes down his throat, Carlos was able to relax a bit, and Layla continued. "I understand why you originally set up these departments the way you did, and I'm so impressed with how you handled all of that on your own for so long. Now that I'm on the team, I can take some of those responsibilities off your plate. Can we discuss making some structural changes? Layla put Carlos at ease, and this put her in a great position to actually be heard by him and then implement the changes that she thought would be best for the company. Five nice ways to segue into a disagreement. After I've gained an understanding of the other person's perspective, the context, and the history, here are the phrases I use to actually voice my contrary opinion. I completely respect where you are coming from on this, and that's a valid point, and it's much less abrasive to say and instead of but. Let's explore this together. Tell me a little more about. It sounds to me like we both want. Let me share with you. This is much more collaborative than let me tell you. Speaking up to impropriety. Like most women, I faced a handful of occasions throughout my career where men have made sexist or rude comments to me. These situations are always difficult, and it can be incredibly challenging to speak up in a way that feels authentic when you're caught off guard by a remark that makes you feel deeply uncomfortable. When I was in my early 30s, I was in a meeting with a senior executive at my company. We were gathered in a conference room working late one night to meet a big deadline. The general discussion centered on a few new features that would be included in a website redesign. Specifically, we were talking about what size the main photo on the homepage should be. The conversation turned to the types of photos that we could post to get the highest response. Out of nowhere, the senior executive said, "Let's post a photo of Fran in that short dress she was wearing the other day. That would get a lot of clicks." The room went totally quiet. It was beyond awkward. I froze for a second and then said, "Can I please talk to you outside?" We went out into the hallway and I told him flatly, "If you want to get the best work out of me, that is not the way to do it." I could tell by the look on his face that he was horrified, and he apologized immediately. He explained that it was late, and he was just trying to lighten the stress in the room given the deadline. There may have been some truth to that, but it really didn't matter. I told him that whatever his original intention was, saying something like that was completely unacceptable. He apologized profusely, and what he did next really surprised me. When we went back into the room, he apologized to the whole team. He said that he was trying to lighten the mood, but that what he had said was completely inappropriate, and that he had so much respect for me and for the work that I do. This was a really important moment for me in terms of setting an example for the other women in that room. At that moment, I was so tired and drained from working so late that I didn't overthink my response ahead of time. And the response that had popped out actually ended up serving me well. When I thought about it later, I saw that he might not have responded as positively if I had called him out in front of everyone. I didn't need to do that. Everyone immediately knew that I was standing up for myself when I asked to talk to him outside. Tying my response to my performance was also key, because it allowed me to remain objective while talking about such an awkward and personal subject. Offhand and unwanted comments like this do happen, but I have to say that I never heard any inappropriate comments from that particular executive again. If I had, then I would have definitely approached HR about it. If you face a situation like this, there is nothing wrong with going to HR right away. But I found it very effective to call it out in the moment, in private, and in a way that was directly tied to my performance. My dear friend, Adora Udoji, a media executive, producer, and investor, shared a story with me about a time early in her career when she had to speak up for herself. She was still in law school when she went for an interview with a deputy chief counsel. As soon as Adora walked in the door, the man who was going to interview her took one look at her, a young woman of color, and said, "You don't look anything like a tax lawyer." Adora's heart sank. She really wanted this job and had done so much work to prepare. This seemed so unfair. But what could she do? She knew that she had the right qualifications for the job, but how could she respond in a way that would convey that his comment was out of line without alienating him entirely? After pausing for a moment, she said calmly, "I think tax lawyers come in all shapes and colors." From there, Adora tried to engage herself fully in the substance of their conversation. The man she was interviewing with soon saw that she knew her stuff, and she ended up feeling good about their conversation, even though she didn't get the job. Adora told me that the experience was painful. It hurt her, but it didn't end her. In fact, it left her feeling hopeful that he wouldn't make the same assumptions the next time a woman of color walked in the room. I was so inspired by Adora's approach and her desire to increase opportunities for the other women who will come up behind her. I hope that if something like this happens to you, you'll find the courage to speak up and encourage the other women at your company to do the same. The nice girl versus the bully. The first time I had to deal firsthand with a bully at work was when I was in my early 30s, shortly after AOL acquired MoviePhone. We were based in New York City, and my boss asked me to partner on a project with Ryan, who was based on the West Coast. It didn't take me long to see that Ryan was toxic. He was mean, he yelled, he interrupted me in meetings constantly, and he micromanaged like crazy. To make things even worse, he was completely ineffective. He frequently made big promises, like being able to connect with an A-list actor to be part of a program we were working on, and then he never followed through. My strategy in working with Ryan was to simply focus on getting the work done. While relationships with colleagues have always been important to me, I knew that engaging with Ryan on a personal level would not be productive. So I did my best to stay true to myself while still keeping my distance and tuning out his negativity. Unfortunately, this approach only worked for so long. The final straw came when he called me at home on a Sunday and yelled at me about the A-list actor not being on board, even though this part of the program was his only responsibility. For what felt like 10 minutes, he would not let me get a word in as he ranted about how I'd failed. Finally, he stopped to take a breath, and I jumped at the chance to respond. I told him very directly, "Ryan, I'm confused. I thought it was your responsibility to secure the celebrity. But regardless, at this point, the program will be fine without him, and we're wasting energy discussing it because it's too late. We launch in 2 days." He started yelling again, and I said, "I'm not going to listen while you speak to me this way." I hung up and decided in that moment that I would no longer work with him. The next morning, I went to my boss and explained the situation. I made sure to use only the facts of what had happened, not just the day before, but also in previous instances, and not base the conversation on feelings. Finally, I said, "I've given it my best try, and I can no longer work with Ryan. I think it would be best if you take him off the program. He's not only a bully, but he's also ineffective." My boss tried to convince me to give it another shot. "I can't do that," I said. "His behavior is abusive. I won't tolerate it, and I don't want my team to be exposed to it." I was very calm yet firm in my delivery, and I was glad that I'd taken time to calm down after the conversation the day before. My boss ultimately agreed, and Ryan was taken off the program. I've thought a lot about this experience with Ryan in the years since then, and I've also seen bullying take on many different forms at work. Not just yelling or hurling insults, but also talking behind someone's back, sabotaging their work, or spreading negative rumors. These are extremely difficult situations, and they can be even more challenging for nice girls who so value getting along with their coworkers and are often very likely to take a bully's actions personally. Throughout the years, I've learned to recognize that someone else's bad behavior has nothing to do with me, and then separate myself from it by acknowledging that I'm powerless to change it. All I can do is act with intention. When I face situations like this, I found it useful to choose one or more of the following 3 courses of action. Set emotional boundaries. If you acknowledge to yourself that this person is a bully and are determined not to let it bother you, by all means try and make it work. But if you do this, make sure you have people in your corner who will support you and protect yourself by setting emotional boundaries. Do not engage in drama and never allow yourself to get swept up in someone else's bad behavior. It takes a lot of confidence and self-knowledge to stay true to yourself in this type of environment. Often we nice girls carry around a tiny seed of doubt that a conflict is somehow our fault. When a bully spots that doubt, he or she will be very likely to prey on it. If you find yourself in a situation like this, look for allies at work who can remind you that this behavior has nothing to do with you. Then when you see it take place, simply acknowledge it. "Oh, it's happening again." And remind yourself that he or she is the one with the problem, not you. This is a simple but powerful way of separating yourself from the other person's toxicity. My friend Jack once faced a situation like this at work. He had a client who was consistently insulting and abusive, despite Jack's many efforts to make the relationship work. Jack prides himself on developing strong relationships with his clients, so to some extent, he couldn't help but blame himself. But when he finally went to the client's boss and explained, "I can't seem to make this relationship work. I'm afraid I'm not the right fit," the boss responded by saying, "Five other people have come forward with the same types of issues. It's not you." This truth is so important to remember, especially if you're a nice girl who prides herself on getting along with everyone. It's not you. Call it out. This is what I did with Ryan, and it's a strong option if you are in good standing at your company and have supporters who will stand up for you. Calling out a bully takes a lot of guts, but it's often worth it. Not only do you stand a good chance of forcing this person to improve his or her behavior, but you are also taking a step toward creating a kinder and healthier work environment. It's important to note that I did not report Ryan's behavior the first time he said something disparaging to me. Good people make mistakes, and this doesn't automatically mean that they are bullies. If someone makes one inappropriate comment, like the executive who commented about posting a picture of me in my skirt, I recommend addressing it directly and then moving on. But if the behavior is consistent, it's time to question whether it constitutes bullying. There's often a fine line between a person who isn't as nice as you'd like and someone who is actually abusive. Some people aren't interested in developing relationships at work and are completely focused on getting the job done. So they act demanding and cold instead of warm and fuzzy. That's not ideal, but it's not abusive either. To me, the definition of a bully is someone who makes consistent personal attacks or comments that are degrading, demeaning, insulting, offensive, or sexually inappropriate. If you are indeed being bullied, gather as much evidence as possible, emails, etc., and then go to HR or to the other person's boss if you have a good relationship with him or her, and calmly explain the situation. To make sure it comes across as a professional conversation rather than tattling, focus on facts and how this person's behavior is affecting your work rather than how it makes you feel. I also recommend starting this conversation the same way as any difficult discussion, by directly saying, "This is going to be a difficult conversation," or "This is something I've been really struggling with." Move on. The unfortunate truth is that there are a lot of bullies who are deeply entrenched in a workplace environment and aren't going anywhere. Sometimes it's even your boss who is the bully. If you've gone to HR and the situation is not improved, or you sense that the bully is well protected and has a lot of political power within the company, it may be best to start looking for another job. Ultimately, you have to weigh the pros and cons for yourself based on how much exposure you have to this person and how much it is affecting you and your work. This is one reason you should focus on networking, see Chapter 7, so that you never find yourself stuck in a bad situation with nowhere else to turn. When you make networking a priority, you develop a large safety net comprised of individuals who can help you find a position in a healthier environment. Create this net before you need it. If you do leave your job for this reason, I recommend being candid during your exit interview with HR. Tell them, "One reason I was open to other opportunities is that this wasn't an entirely healthy work environment. Hopefully the company will not want to lose any more talent and will finally take care of this problem." Here are a few phrases that I rely on when I'm dealing with a bully. "Please don't talk to me that way." "Let's try to get this conversation to a place where it can be productive." "Let's take a break and come back to this later." Woman spreading. Improving your nonverbal communication. It's not just what we say, but how we say it that telegraphs our strength or weakness to others. Albert Mehrabian, a psychology professor at UCLA, is a pioneer in the study of communication. He theorizes that your credibility is judged 58% by your overall body language, 35% by your tone of voice, and only 7% by what you actually say. Pretty shocking, isn't it? Once I learned this, it served as a kind of wake-up call. I really started to focus not just on the content of my communication, but also on how I said it and what body language I used when I spoke. This requires taking an honest look at yourself and deciding what you can improve. Do you slouch, avoid eye contact, or speak too softly? Many of us have as much trouble with body language and our tone of voice as we do with speaking up, which takes us back to the old issue of camouflage. Many women have unconsciously trained themselves from girlhood not to stand out from the crowd. This includes how we speak, stand, sit, and even how much space we take up. Recently, there's been a lot said in the media about the fact that men take up much more physical space than women do, irrespective of size. Men do it unconsciously, claiming power and asserting dominance in every room they enter, while women tend to diminish their presence, often due to the messages